Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casella. With me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy mid-June. Happy, what do we got? Oh, happy, I mean, lacrosse future is now settled. Did you guys have the podcast last week before that was announced or after? I forget.
It was after, because that kind of came like on the weekend.
Okay. Right. Okay. I just trying to remember the timing of it. Yeah. What a crazy few weeks. But then more news today, which we were got a hint at pretty soon after the gate news came, is Dave Petromala. What craziness?
Yeah. This is
what a ridiculous like total. I mean, I think people when it was first reported by I think Brent Axe, like, I feel like people said it was like some like message board, like fever dream nonsense, but here we are.
Yeah, I know one of the comments on the article on the blog was like, this is like hiring John Thompson to be an assistant for Boeheim. Like, that actually wouldn't have been the worst thing, to be honest.
The one I said, and I have to like go dig it up, I tweeted something out after the news that people, oh, there we go. I said it was basically if Gino Auriemma took over for Calhoun at UConn, but if Gino was also Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about, that was about Gate. and then to throw in the Petromala thing, just like, I mean, what would be the equivalent there is if like he hired, if he hired like John Thompson, just crazy. Like, it's just a wild whole set of things. I mean, I think it should hopefully quell some of the concerns about, like, I mean, if there were too many concerns about Gate being able to adjust to now the men's game. He has one of the most experienced and successful men's head coaches on his staff now, also shoring up the defense, which was a major concern this year. And also there's like some recruiting angles there as well. So yeah, wow. Just it's just a lot.
Yeah. For those who weren't following along, his son is the number two rated recruit for 2022. So as Dan and I were joking before we started, we're turning into the Kentucky basketball of men's lacrosse. Plenty of other programs do that sort of thing too, of course, but just looking at one that you might want to reference.
Yeah. At least it's a successful one. He's committed currently to UNC, right? He's either committed or he's like heavily leaning there. I forget exactly.
He is committed to UNC. Obviously, the big draw, and maybe not for him, but at least for his parents, is the fact that, you know, he would get, after the first year, get an employee discount and get free tuition. Also, wouldn't count against our scholarships, which
is huge for lacrosse.
Yeah, absolutely. When you don't have a ton of full scholarships or really any to speak of, and you're kind of dividing them up between a large team. So could be huge. We shall see there. Definitely seems like a pretty exciting staff for SU. You know, all the consternation around, you know, SU men's lacrosse hiring the school's women's lacrosse coach away aside, I do think that, you know, Gate seems to be approaching things well, and at least setting himself up for success. And really, like, that, you know, I think the standard here, Gate obviously has I think he still has like the sort of wiggle room, because he has just, you know, the Hall of Fame credentials, the history at SU, like, he has wiggle room here, but I don't necessarily know how long people are going to be willing to wait, even if Gary Gate is coaching the team, how long people are going to be willing to wait until SU's, you know, back to playing on Memorial Day weekend every year.
Yeah, no, I think there's real pressure. I think there's real pressure in the men's program because, like, there's talent on the roster. This was a team that was entering the season seen as like a national championship contender. You're hoping that Gate is able to spark something that kind of returns the team to where it was 2 years ago, and maybe it's just kind of a new voice and a new face can help do that. Because you know, not to put it all on Desto, but like clearly something, there was like just something fell apart this year. And I don't think he would have gotten Forsett. I think he was probably like okay with handing things over to, you know, one of the greatest players in the history of the sport, someone who's coached at SU, who like is very ingrained in the culture. Yeah, I think the concerns for the women's program are quite legitimate. At the same time, it's like, I wonder if like it's been understood that whenever Desto hung it up, whether it was this year or next year or whenever, like that Gate would have the shot. And if that's the case, which wouldn't surprise me, and you know, but there hasn't been any like reporting on this, it's just like you're reading between the lines. Like it makes sense that with how things worked out, that like he at least had a pretty decent understanding that he would have a shot at the job. If he hadn't gotten it, then like you're probably losing Gate at some point down the line from the women's team as well. So if this was like a goal of his that he wasn't going to be able to achieve. So at the same time, hopefully the powers that be, Wildhack and everyone, go and make a really thoughtful, like strong women's hire. And to that program is on the precipice of a national championship too. And I think they need to take advantage of that. They can't settle on with that program. Like we need to go take home a title. Like the program's way too close to not. So I'm not going to get too worked up about it. As long as whatever we do with the women's program is like thoughtful and we hire like a really competitive staff and like we're showing the investment in that program as well and not just like kicking them to the curb.
Definitely agree. Kevin and I talked about that a little bit last time out, but yeah, I think that hopefully we see a new hire soon, over on the women's side. Hopefully, you know, the salary allowances that were freed up for Gate were not just, because of his Hall of Fame credentials as a player, but also just because the school is willing to invest, you know, heavily in the women's program. So hopefully we see more of that, going forward. Moving on to a couple other items, here, we want to stick with Syracuse stuff for a little bit, before we get to, college football playoff, which does touch Syracuse, even if tangentially at the moment, and then some NBA playoff talk, before we wrap up today, since Dan will have, you know, a chance to air some grievances, I'm sure. But talking first, Willie Tyler, offensive tackle commit from Texas. Never actually played at Texas, but commit from Texas. He was transferring to SU. He decommitted late last week. Bummer to see, you know, us lose anyone else on the offensive line. But at the same time, there's clearly a reason. There's also clearly like a good influx of talent, even if unproven talent. On the line of late, SU still has a ton of guys that they've added in recent years, despite the departures. And I think, you know, having a regime change there as well on the offensive line coaching front is just, all in all, I think is good for us. And I think that, you know, while I'm bummed not to see Tyler, I think that SU clearly has some other plans in place. And I'm hoping that, you know, obviously they turn out well.
I think just given his history with college football so far, it like can't come as that big a surprise. It's disappointing because like he seemed like a high upside guy. You know, anytime you get a transfer from Texas, even if there were like some asterisks there, you know, you hope to bring some guy like that in. But it does seem like we have stopped some talent over the last couple of years. We have a fresh, you know, we've refreshed that side of the ball and with our new offensive line coach, and like I don't know, it seems like the things we've heard coming out of spring have been mostly positive, so it's hard to like get too worked up over a guy who hadn't even like been here yet, but at the same time, like it would have been nice to bring him in just you know, just to compete. So I don't know that it's like a huge loss, but you hope that they have a plan in place, and I think they do.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, obviously, again, like we've added a ton of guys. I think that there's, you know, like someone like Jacob Bradford, who was a JUCO transfer, like does seem like someone who could potentially step up. Again, we really didn't know what we were going to get out of Tyler in year one. Anyway, this isn't to downplay the loss. I don't want to act like this, you know, we were pretty excited about adding him, so we can't suddenly be like, you know, shrug about him leaving. But I do think that, you know, that's another spot that we could potentially, you know, use down the road and add some more talent. And I think that while, again, unproven across the board so far in terms of depth on the line, we still have a lot of guys we could potentially plug in. And I'm hoping that, you know, regime change and just what seems like a refocused approach on offense this offseason helps us out a ton. I mean, really nothing could be worse in the last 2 years in terms of protection, in terms of O-line health. And I know people were joking, but hopefully we don't see Chris Elmore back on the line, despite the fact that he was actually pretty effective there last year.
Yeah, if we could not have to convert defensive linemen / fullbacks to offensive line, I think that would be a major step forward for the program.
I would concur.
Yeah, but no, I totally agree. I think we very much needed an overhaul of that situation at that position. Obviously, it's nice that Mike Kavanaugh got a landing spot at Arizona State, and excited about just all of that. Like, I think it was much needed after the last couple of years. And I guess the upside is, like, hopefully some of these guys that have gotten thrust into, like, serious playing time the last few years, which we say over and over, but hopefully this is, like, the season where it starts to bear fruit and, like, you have a bunch of experienced players who have been overwhelmed in the past, but will start to, like, fit, you know, fill out as players and take advantage of the situation. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, if we have good offensive line play, I think we're, like, in pretty good shape. That's just such a major key that we've been so far behind in.
Yeah, I really like, and that I think is such a core issue for this team. I mean, we've seen individual performances as well as group performances fare well at linebacker spot, at defensive line, in the secondary, you know, even quarterback play, wide receiver play. Like we saw, you know, Sean Tucker run well last year. Really, like, the line is the glaring issue, especially in the last couple seasons. As we kind of, you know, diagnose what's wrong, I think, and Dino said it himself, it kind of starts with the line. And then I think SU, unfortunately, from a play calling standpoint, has just been forced into some unenviable hands as a result of just poor offensive line play. And there's only so much you can do. That's not an excuse. And I wouldn't say that the play calling has been acceptable in the last two seasons, but I think noting and understanding the line issues at least informs some of how we got there.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, that's going to be kind of the make or break thing for this season in general. Like, if it doesn't get better, we're, you know, the Babers era is in real trouble. But I will hold out hope, because I do think we've heard more good things in the last couple months than we had even, like, going into last year, where it was like, you know, we were hoping things were going to improve, but there was certainly no guarantee. And also, like, the abridged, like, chaotic offseason certainly didn't help matters, I don't think.
No, not at all. I mean, if people recall, SU had, like, a handful of practices before everything was ceased, and then they weren't back on campus, you know, until like late July. So that's a lot of time with some young players, with, you know, some new systems on both sides of the ball. Like, the defense was able to adjust. So, and I know a lot of critics had that to say, of, like, how come the defense was able to figure it out? Like, the defense did figure it out, admittedly, but I do think that the defense figured it out almost in spite of itself. And you did see an improvement at certain aspects of things over the course of the year, while in others, like the linebackers, I felt like, as they were relatively healthy, you saw linebacker improvement over the course of the year. While I'd argue that you saw diminishing returns, you know, in the secondary, despite some bright spots, just because of injuries. And I think you saw, you know, defensive line, while it was veteran laden, didn't necessarily ever put it together. Cause I think they could have done better, I also think that they had to carry a lot of water for a very young team in every other spot.
Yeah. It's also like, I don't know. I think we shouldn't just, like, it's almost kind of shocking how good the defense was last year, to be honest. Like, we obviously had talented players there, as we saw with the three defensive backs who are all in the NFL now. And, you know, we knew we had other good players on the roster, but, like, it wouldn't have been surprising if the program had kind of, like, fallen off on that side a little bit too, just because of all the pressure put on it by the offense being a total, like, mess. So, yeah, I don't know that, like, it's fair to assume that the offense should have just been able to, obviously it should have been better than it was, like, that it's not its use by any means, but just because the defense was so, like, shockingly good last year doesn't mean the offense is going to be able to overcome all of those same things. That being said, the offense just can't be that bad again. Like, it has to take a major step forward. And, you know, hopefully we just have more depth and more, you know, time in with our, you know, we have new coaches at positions of need. We have guys who are now in their second or third years coaching, like Sterling Gilbert. Hopefully he, you know, starts to pay dividends. And just hopefully health in general is improved, because that has also been a major factor. And hopefully we don't get to our like fourth quarterback. So like, and even if we do, the fourth quarterback will probably be more talented than it was last year. So there's just a lot. I think there are reasons for optimism, even if, like, you know, it's hard to just guarantee like this major shift forward to a bowl or whatever. I think, you know, you can allow yourself to be optimistic about the factors that we like know and seem to have some control over.
Yeah, I completely agree. Dan, I know we're kind of limited on time today, so maybe we do a little halftime here. We can get into some of our other topics for the day. So what have you been drinking of late?
Cool. I've had a couple decent things. I realized I forgot to check into whatever I had with Andy at the Nets game, the last good Nets game, which is a shame. It was some good collaboration between, I want to say, Fats Farm and Other Half. I'll try to look it up while we're going. But things I did remember to check in. I had got my hands on some lunch by Maine a week ago, which always a big win. I picked up a 4-pack of Coated Tiles from LIC Beer Project, one of the better pale ales from the city. I was up in Connecticut for a couple days last week, and I had some Sea Hag from New England Brewing, one of the better Connecticut breweries. Had some Moon Mosa from Stillwater Artisanal, which is a Brooklyn brewery, but had it up there. Really delicious, kind of like a tangerine-y sour, super drinkable. And then also had some Sip of Sunshine from Lawson's, which was, always nice to find.
Oh, yeah. That one's always a winner. Always try to drink some. Actually, I don't really go out of my way to find it when I'm on the East Coast, but it usually pops up. Which is always appreciated. On my end, I was in Montana last week, for much of last week into the weekend. Had a bunch of new stuff from Bozeman Brewing Company, had Hop Zone IPA that was pretty good. From Phillipsburg Brewing, had Montana One. Lone Peak had a couple interesting ones. Hippie Highway was actually really good. Actually, it was at the brewery, so tried that one. That was actually really good oatmeal stout. Had... From Mountains Walking Brewing, had Nice Fella Pilsner. It's kind of an Italian-style Pilsner. It was pretty good. Then June Grass IPA. That was really good. They actually did – like, I did not expect Montana beer scene to be, like, this solid all around. And I felt like they did a nice job of some West Coast styles, some East Coast styles. So I was definitely impressed there. Also had from Map Brewing, Midas Crush. That was kind of a hybrid, kind of hazy West Coast IPA. And then I had Checkmate Pilsner from Red Lodge and Scepter IPA from Driftworks. So all around, nice to be in the mountains and nice to drink some good beer.
Shouts to Montana.
Yeah, shouts to Montana. Again, underrated beer scene. So definitely, if you're in the mountain states, definitely check it out. So Dan, one of the other, like the last, like strictly Syracuse related topic today that I want to talk about in light of the rewatch series that we're going to be doing for Syracuse men's basketball this offseason and that James is going to be running. I wanted to ask you maybe a handful of Syracuse games, any sport that you wish News Magician had been around for. For those who forget, News Magician has been around since October 2006. That is quite a while ago, but that still leaves a lot of Syracuse history left uncovered. So curious if you had, I know that all of these will predate your fandom, but curious if you had any games right at the top of your head that, that you definitely like to see.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously the obvious ones, like the 2003 run, like we would have had just right. So much fun, like so much fun. I think this has been discussed on the site, like semi-recently, the 1996 run, I think, kind of gets overshadowed for a lot of reasons. It's like kind of like the proto. Obviously, we were a four seed, so it wasn't like we were like giant underdogs. But it was kind of like the proto whatever we've been doing these last couple years run, where we weren't really like a huge national championship team, like team with those kind of aspirations. Obviously had one great player with John Wallace and a nice surrounding cast. I think that run, which, you know, I've seen parts of, I've seen that national championship game a couple times in Kentucky, but I think, yeah, like seeing maybe like the Mississippi State game in the Final Four, and also maybe the game against Kansas in the Elite Eight, and the Georgia game, honestly.
That whole run there. I mean, like the Drexel game, I don't think anyone wants to relive like that terror. Even if 11-point win, yes, but at the same time, like you just don't want to relive that against a, you know, tricky 12 seed. But yeah, the Georgia, Kansas, Mississippi State, even the Kentucky game, like that 4-game run, I think, like you said, would have had a great time kind of sitting around in a game thread. And one of like the old school game threads. Maybe not like some of the newer game threads. No offense to the frequenters of it, but obviously game threads, I think in general, have just changed dramatically in terms of, you know, the conversation. And I think part of it too is just quality of play that just gets everybody a little more irritable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just kind of natural. I mean, obviously there's, you know, things that you would hope would go better, but like, you know, things are going to be more fun when teams are doing well. I'd also probably say like the 87 football team, but like specifically the bowl game, I think like it would have been very frustrating, but also would have been very, very good content.
Yeah. Great content. Good jokes. I know for me, the 2002 Syracuse Virginia Tech game that went 3 overtimes would have been a really fun one. We won 50-42 in that game. I think some other ones that I had like written down. Those were some of the bigger ones. What else? Oh, so that was one. Syracuse Virginia Tech in 1998, the 28-26 game when Sean rushed the field with his mom would be another big one. Obviously, I think 1959 against Texas. 87 is a couple of different games on there that you could point to. I think as much as it was a loss, the Tennessee game for Syracuse and T. Martin, I think, you know, there's a lot of entertaining results there. Again, as much as like the game itself was annoying, I think a lot of fans, you know, probably would have at least enjoyed taking solace with their fellow Orange fans online. Bunch of lacrosse games, I won't even like get in. I mean, really any of the national championship games, any of the Final Fours would have been entertaining rewatches with this group.
The 09 game, honestly, like, might be up there. Obviously, the site was around, but right. Like, obviously, just super crazy. One of the first, one of my first major lacrosse games. I also didn't go up for that. That was in Foxboro, and I like kicked myself to this day for not trip up.
Yeah, I didn't either. I mean, granted, a little bit closer for you, but definitely wish I'd made that trek. Some other interesting games I wanted to point out on the football side. 2003, 49-47 win over North Carolina. That would have been a fun one. Let's see. This is, you know, spectacular content. I guess just for the lulls, would have loved to have the Gator Bowl from 1995, 41-0 win over Clemson. Would have just been a great time, both in hindsight and now. That could have been, definitely a good time there. Liberty Bowl against Houston, too, in 1996. Not necessarily, you know, the worst rewatch ever. Some other ones. We had, like, some really weird games in the 90s. Where, like, the 28-20 win in 1994 against Virginia Tech was another good one that I probably toss on there. But we really did have, like, a lot of weird, like, 1993 game against Texas, 21-21 tie. Annoying.
I have like very little memory about hearing about that.
Yeah,
Texas.
Just definitely a dumb result, but one that I think would absolutely like be fun for this group to have watched together. 92 Fiesta Bowl would be another good one. 26-22 over Colorado. Sorry, no, I'm just kind of like going through a list because I had like a bunch in my head and then I wanted to make sure we covered a few more. The Hall of Fame Bowl in 1991 over Ohio State, 24-17, would be another good one. The Diamond Ferry game in 2004.
Of course.
Can't believe I forgot that one to this point. Absolutely worth reliving.
We still troll BC over that game like today.
Yeah, even though at this point, like, BC has the upper hand on us in a couple things.
That's 89, fine. That game still happened.
Yeah, it still happened. Two games that I think we definitely should have had a rewatch for, or should have a rewatch for now. The Coca-Cola Classic against Louisville in 1989 in Tokyo, 24-13 win. And then the 1918 win over Georgia in the Peach Bowl. Somehow we got matched up with a 6-6 Georgia squad, and yeah, we beat them in the Peach Bowl. So we are now the residents of the Peach Bowl. There is no other team that's ever won the Peach Bowl because we won it against Georgia in the state.
Really, kind of an unfair draw, but yeah, give us credit. The 1918 boys like really socked it to them, or whatever you'd say as a watcher of the 1918 Syracuse Orangemen.
Just roughed them up. Another one. I know we've talked about it before. That Tokyo game makes no sense to me still to this day, because it's just odd. And make that like those sort of exhibitions weren't part of the regular season at any point in like college football's history. So I'm confused as to how that game happened. I'd love a 30 for 30 on that one, admittedly. Another one in there, and I'd say this is probably like the end of the list, the 1984 upset over Nebraska, obviously, would be like,
yeah, kind of
like
that's the last one. That's towards the top of the list for sure.
Indeed. I'm sure there's plenty more that that folks will voice opinions about. The last thing I kind of want to talk about today, maybe, unless we get some NBA time, is college football playoff expansion. Now, nothing's been finalized yet, as you know, Dan, but
it's very much down the road.
It's very much down the road. B, it's, you know, very much in flux a bit. I mean, I think it's going to get verified at this point because it seems like all the powers that be are on board. What I don't understand, I know others have brought up too, is why on earth would Notre Dame agree to a structure where it can't get one of the four first round byes?
It's pretty shocking that, like, I mean, Notre Dame has like sway. I don't know that they have the sway to prevent like the Power Five from doing something it wants, even though it's kind of surprising that
they're even part of a working group, is what I don't know.
Yeah, that's the surprising part, is that Jack Swarbrick was like in the group.
Yeah, let's do this.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Like, it's like one of the few things recently that's happened that's kind of maybe pushed Notre Dame joining the ACC full time to like being more realistic, which I am in full support of. Because, you know, I think that's at some point the ACC needs to find like a big move here. And that's like Jim Phillips' like first job, and like his only like super important job is finding a way to like cut down the deficit, the growing deficit between the Big Ten, SEC, and then like us. And adding Notre Dame and then probably another team would be a huge, huge, huge win. And a college football playoff where Notre Dame can't have a bye, even though it's made multiple playoffs, so it's not in the top four multiple times, is like, that's a big disadvantage for them if they're trying to win a national championship, which they supposedly are. So like, yeah, maybe they'll say like, whatever, the independence is worth getting like topped out of the five seed. But like, if they have a couple of those draws, whether it's the five or the six, and they could have possibly been the four, and they lose early, like, that's going to start grading on them. And there's also like the younger cohort of Notre Dame fans, maybe they're not super passionate about joining the ACC, but they're much more open to getting rid of the independence. And we saw like this year had worked out really well for them with the ACC. So yeah, like that would be huge. And then just in general, especially on the Syracuse side, like it's big news for SU. Obviously like 2018, they wouldn't have gotten a 12 team field, but they would have been right on the outside looking in. And there's like a universe, there's much more of a universe where Syracuse sneaks into a 12 team field than there is Syracuse sneaking into a 14 field. So at the end of the day, that's just massive for them. I think it's really cool for the group of fives. I'm kind of shocked that they're getting as good a deal as they are, because they get screwed over at every turn in college football. So I'm a big fan. I think this really brings everyone to the table in a lot of ways. Like, you're going to probably see multiple group of five teams fairly often with how this is set up, unless like unless the committee just decides to screw them over now, which is possible, but you'll see at least one. So yeah, I'm a fan of what they've done. I think you can make the argument 12 is too many, but I kind of like where they've gotten, and I'm again just super, super surprised.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of surprises here. I think that the 12 team thing makes a lot of sense, though. I mean, you and I have obviously been like very passionate observers of what's happened with the playoff over the last, you know, half decade. And I think one of the biggest issues is really how much the four team event and the kind of staticness of the field over time has really like diminished interest in some of the lesser games. I think it's left a lot of teams, maybe not us necessarily, but left a lot of teams like kind of nonplussed by the time you get to November, where if you're out of that 14 event and ESPN's leaned so heavily into that marketing, that it's become kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that like all the free publicity, all the free kind of gassing up that they do for all these teams, just kind of assures that, you know, Ohio State, Alabama, Clemson, Oklahoma in particular, are just, you know, the best and that's it. And yeah, there's ways around that, and some teams have been able to break through, but ultimately, like, those teams have controlled this event from the start, and it's definitely I think it's worn on the sport. It's made the sport, I know last year was kind of an exception, but I know you and I, you know, big college football fans, definitely didn't feel, you know, the same kind of enjoyment last season that we do typically. And I think over time it's definitely worn on me, you know, how marginalized, I guess, the rest of college football is by a 4-team event. I think a 12-team event doesn't necessarily open access a ton. I think you still see the same teams win more often than not. But that's always been the case in college football. It's not as if this is a new phenomenon. So for me, I think that, you know, this is the sort of thing where it makes the postseason more interesting. It makes it at least look more accessible. It is in function more accessible because you're getting, you know, group of five teams in. You're really providing a path for, there is no necessarily like power five anymore, as much as there's just a, you know, the top six conference champs. So like last year, like Coastal Carolina would have like qualified over Oregon, which, you know, damning to the Pac-12, but it also, you know, I think it motivates everyone a lot more, and it provides a lot more meaningful games, you know, from mid-October, early November on, where people are jockeying, and there's a lot of, you kind of get a bit of a like bubble, NCAA tournament bubble situation, but for probably a larger group of teams and a larger group of teams that don't really, you know, they have varying opportunities to improve their station versus the way it works in college basketball, where like everyone kind of has all those teams end up having a chance to get in, just because of the size of that field and the nature of, you know, automatic bids with conferences. But I think in this case, this is a fun way to keep those games interesting, keep fans engaged, and you know, stop the incessant focus on, well, if you're not in the top four, it doesn't really matter, which I think is good for the sport overall.
I think the bottom line is that they were looking for just a way to get more schools involved, as you said. And like, while the SEC probably kind of loves its own dominance, they kind of get the double win here, where like ultimately you want the team to grow and you want to remain on top of the team growing, but also now they have the opportunity to maybe get like four or five teams in the field. So they'll probably take the trade off where like, oh, there will still be more attention paid elsewhere as well. But it's not good. Like, it being hyper-regional, like, it's always going to be that to an extent, but you want less of that. You want less of that if you're the sport and you're like the powers that be, because you can't just rely on like one or two leagues having, you know, giving the most of the attention. It just doesn't end up working out as well as you probably hope there. So
no. Yeah, and we always think, too, like, it didn't necessarily, like, the 14 playoff did not support larger conferences like as a concept either, because realistically you're just cutting off access to the playoff. This actually makes it, I don't think super teams conferences end up happening, but I think that this puts it back on the table as an afterthought, if only because you're no longer, you know, completely like crippled by finishing, you know, second or third in your league, versus now in a 4-team event, if you don't win your league, you're screwed, and that's it. And to me, I was scratching my head the whole time as expansion was happening, thinking, like, once the playoff was official, why would you join a league that you're never going to win, or you're rarely going to have even a chance to win? Why would you put yourself in the situation where you're always knocking on the door, but you're never close enough? Now, it doesn't matter. You could finish fourth in the SEC and conceivably still make the playoff and have a shot to play for it. And I think that that's that at least makes all these conference realignment moves make more sense in hindsight and in the future.
Yeah, I do wonder if you see more the expansion being more, and you're kind of seeing this already with a lot of the FCS stuff, but I think Matt Brown might have written about like the potential of like the ASUN moving up, which has already been kind of in the out there in the world, and then also maybe you see more of a shuffling in terms of the better, like the AAC maybe looking to add more competitive teams, or teams looking to move up to like those more competitive leagues because they might see that as a better gateway to getting to the playoff, because like more often than not, there's probably going to be at least one AAC or Mountain West team. But even this year, like Coastal would have made it. So had we had the same exact rankings, they would have gotten one of the auto bids, which is crazy. So I wonder if like a lot of the expansion stuff is going to be kind of a reshuffling of those of schools with big aspirations now looking to maybe set themselves up in better leagues, and whether that becomes like a, well, we want to get into the AAC because you'll have a probably a better resume, or if you're going to see teams more content to try to win their league and do like a Coastal type situation where they're just super super impressive and run through it. And then I wonder like what BYU is going to do, because BYU is not in a great situation now for similar reasons to Notre Dame, but like, there's a universe in which like a one loss BYU maybe sneaks in as like a Mountain West champion, but like unless they're going undefeated as an independent, they don't really have a great shot.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like this puts Notre Dame on an equal footing to BYU, who didn't have the same like them, Army, New Mexico State, UConn, obviously joking on the last few, Liberty, like they didn't have the same access that the G5 did because they weren't part of a league, and there was no real, you know, avenue for them to get into you know, the six access bowls. I think now that becomes even more magnified, and it makes independence an even tougher road to hoe. And again, especially for Notre Dame, who had accepted status over those other ones and now does not, definitely going to be tougher. I think, I know some were saying that, you know, non-conference scheduling becomes a much bigger deal going forward. And I actually think that this could like just reinforce what we already knew, which like the goal of college football is not to lose. Ultimately, it doesn't matter who you face. If you get yourself undefeated and you get yourself to the highest ranking possible at the end of the season, you're in the event. Now, especially now with the 12 team event, where there is no reality where an undefeated conference champ from any of the Power Five leagues, the AAC or the Mountain West, misses this thing. And then I think, you know, maybe debatable on the rest, but that's a lot of leagues that there's a compelling reason to avoid too much, you know, too much friction, I guess, and just try to go unbeaten and then dare the committee to tell you you didn't play anyone hard enough.
Well, I think it may be that for the group of fives or like the lower level schools that are trying to like just make that kind of a run. Right. But if you're like a you know, 4 to 5 ranked SEC team, are you better off trying to play a super hard schedule and just giving your best shot? Because you might be able to sneak in there with 3 losses if your schedule is really hard and you're really competitive. So I do wonder how they're going to approach it, because clearly the schools have been ramping up their scheduling, not going the opposite direction with the thought that that was going to be the case. So that's going to be a fascinating thing to see, along with like, you know, half a dozen other things.
Agreed. More on that in future episodes, I'm sure. We'll have plenty to talk about this offseason once like everything's official and when we know the year and all that. And we can kind of debate like what it would take Syracuse to get into that conversation. Knowing again that we were, you know, a short amount of time away from it. Back in 2018, if a couple balls had bounced our way. Dan, with last like minute or two here, I will give you the floor to complain about your beloved Brooklyn Nets and the fact that the juggernaut might have run over a strip of grenades as we enter what looks like to be a pivotal game 5. For them coming up against the Bucks.
Yeah, it really sucks. I was at game two with Andy last week, which is why I was not on the podcast. It was unbelievable. It was my first sporting event back in person somewhere, and it was a really good one because we won. I mean, it was a 39-point game. It was like teetering on a 50-point game for a bit towards the end. And after that, like, I thought, like, this is going to be over in five probably. I assume Milwaukee would get one at home. Granted, like, we're not, you know, had Milwaukee just gotten the two at home, but we were healthy, it would be a different situation. But now with both Kyrie, who sprained his ankle, looked pretty bad in game four, and then Harden still recovering from a hamstring, both, like, injuries you can't really come back from until you're ready to come back. So it's not like you can just, like, throw them in there. It sucks. I mean, it was, the team looked like it was playing its best basketball through the Celtics series in the first two Bucks games, and to, like, basically be up against the wall because of injuries is brutal. And, like, obviously Kyrie's been pretty injury prone. Harden, like, was never hurt before this year, and now he has missed a lot of time with two separate hamstring pulls. So it's unfortunate. It's hard to, like, I said going into the playoffs, assuming everyone was healthy, that, like, it was kind of championship or bust. And even with two of those three guys being healthy, it was kind of championship or bust. It's hard to feel that way now because of just the situation they're facing, where now it's kind of Durant and a cast of characters that are, like, really good when they're, like, your fourth through, you know, eighth guys. It's not so much when they're your second through sixth. But, you know, I hold on hope. Like, I think if they get one of the two guards back for game six, I think there's still a very good chance they'll find the last two wins here. But it doesn't sound super optimistic. Like, those two injuries are not ones that, like, guys just come back easily from and are, like, step right in and are 100%. So, yeah, it's really unfortunate to miss out on, like, legitimately may miss out on a championship because of injuries. That's not the way you want to do it. So, yeah. At least the Mets are good. The Mets are up 3-0 on the Cubs and are in first place by like seven games in the loss column, so we have that, the Mets, who I can always rely on.
Yeah, I've definitely enjoyed this Mets season so far, and I know I will regret those words at some point in the near future.
They just have like weird, like, they're starting to verge, and this is, I'm knocking on my wooden desk right now, which hopefully you can hear. I just dropped a remote. It has, like, starting to have, like, mid-season 2015 vibes. And also, like, we are not fully healthy and, like, haven't been all year. So they just seem to have, A, it's a fun team, but they just seem to know how to win games. Yeah. DeGrom is having legitimately one of the greatest seasons of all time so far. That's, like, there's in no way is that inaccurate to say. He's, like, up there with, like, 68 Bob Gibson right now. But yeah, they just, like, you have, like, just role players getting huge hits, like the Villars and Pilars of the world, VR, like having just huge games. Alonso's kind of finding himself, Lindor just very much breaking out of like a 2-month slump to start his Mets career. So yeah, I mean, hopefully that continues. But right now, like, they're the only team in the NL East that seems to be, like, interested in playing any kind of consistent ball. So I'll certainly take it. And if I have to trade, like, the Nets for the Mets, like, I'm unfortunately for the Nets, I'm going to do that every time. So, yeah, it looks like we're in very good shape, especially considering the Mets have had a hilarious number of injuries themselves.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, like, this is one of those weird seasons. And I mean, a lot of time left. I know that there's definitely exceptions to, like, I mean, they've looked rough at times. They've looked really good at times. I don't think this is a juggernaut by any means. I think if this team goes on a run, it's going to be one of those, you know, classic Mets, like, how the hell did this happen sort of things, because that's the only way this team knows how to win things. When the Mets, you know, run roughshod over a schedule, that's usually when the bad things occur, or at least has been since post-1986. So realistically, as much as I would love to just win 100 games and feel great, I think I would still enjoy, I think history has told me in my life that does not work for this franchise, and that we're much better off winning 95 games and then, like, pissing people off.
That's fair. I just wonder, like, obviously it's too early to tell, but if we add a healthy Carrasco to the rotation and we add eventually a Syndergaard, and then you have, I mean, if DeGrom keeps on pitching anywhere near what he's doing now, and Stroman keeps on pitching the way he is, and Taiwan Walker continues to pitch the way he is, like, that's gonna be a really hard rotation to deal with down the stretch for other teams. So you know, hopefully, well, fingers crossed, I can't deal with multiple teams getting, and I, you know, this is certainly not a championship or bust year for the Mets. It's like a, I'm very happy to be competitive year. But we'll certainly take what is looking like a, you know, hopefully an NL East championship and at least like a, you know, competitive playoff run this fall. But, you know, we'll see what happens because it can certainly go the other way for the Mets, as we know.
I will conservatively call this a hopeful contention. And if we're lucky, we'll make the playoffs. And I'm not going to change my mind on that until like,
that's fair. I think it's very early. It's very early.
Especially for the Mets, who've lost a lot of games to COVID and then weather already.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're like, I think they're tied for the best, like the fewest losses in the NL, but then they have like eight fewer wins than some of those other teams because of just crazy. The COVID was one thing, but like the rainouts have been nuts. Like they've gotten rained out so many times. It's outrageous. So yeah, lots of like double headers to be had. And
which is fine because our relievers are sketchy. So then we get to cheat because then we get to, well, it depends on the day, but at least in the beginning of the season, relievers were looking rough. So then it was funny to get sketchy wins because we just play seven innings twice and then never have to dip all the way into the relief.
Our first like three relievers are very good. And then it falls off a cliff very fast. Yeah. Hopefully we'll add another like arm or two, in the, you know, ahead of the trade deadline. But, yeah, no, you can't complain about the Mets right now. They are overachieving, given all everything that you've had, especially with like the multiple star players slumping and everything else. So yeah, happy with that. Not less happy with the Nets, but we'll see what happens with my beloved Brooklyn boys, and that's, well, tomorrow.
Fair enough. Dan, anything else before we depart today?
No, that's pretty much it. You know, we didn't talk about my Packers, but I'd rather not. So.
Yeah, we're not talking about the NFL.
We'll leave one for another time for sure.
There's plenty of offseason left. Well, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noonan's An Absolute Podcast. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, Megaphone, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Overcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Go Orange.